Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. There is a very interesting and illuminating discussion of idealism on the part of Immanuel Kant in his Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics in part one, where he's discussing mathematics and he's worked out the idea of a priori intuitions and talked about mathematics as working through space and time, which are indeed a priori intuitions, namely the forms of our sensibility. And he's concerned with whether he's going to be tarred as an idealist, which is kind of a dirty word at the time. And before we jump into looking at that, we should remark that I think a lot of people, if they have gotten their ideas about Kant from reading secondary literature, histories of philosophy, taking an intro to philosophy class, they know that Immanuel Kant is, you know, one of the originators of what we call German idealism. So obviously he must be an idealist of some sort, right? And yes, he is, but he's going to distinguish his conception of idealism, which he thinks is okay, from others which are clearly, in his view, wrong-headed. And he doesn't want to be mixed up with those. So he tells us in Remark 2 that idealism consists in the assertion that there are none but thinking beings. So I kind of andere, no other als denkende Wesen. And when we translate Wesen as beings, okay, that's not bad. It could also be essences, right? Beings makes more sense here. And, you know, typically when we think about idealism as it gets presented in a rather abstract manner, it's that, well, the entire world exists for a thinker, a perceiver, however you want to frame it, and that, you know, the things that we see, we sense, they only exist because we are sensing them, and perhaps there's a God who also senses them, you know, a la Berkeley, or perhaps they have some sort of weird, quirky being of their own, as with Descartes, right? And so Kant says that whatever is given to us as object must be given to us in intuition. All our intuition takes place by means of the senses. The understanding intuits nothing but only reflects. And we've just shown the senses never and in no manner enable to know things in themselves, but only their appearance, which are mere representations of the sensibility. So isn't this manifest idealism? We only have appearances or Scheinungen or Vorstellungen, you know, representations. And so, you know, this could be idealistic. And Kant goes on and he says, on the contrary, I say, things as objects of our senses existing outside of ourselves are given. There are actual things out there. However, you can't by means of the senses, or as it's going to turn out by the understanding or reason, either these other faculties, we know nothing of what they may be in themselves, an sich selbst, right? Knowing only their appearances, that is the representations which they cause in us by affecting our senses. And he says, I grant there's bodies outside of us. We just don't get to see what they are in themselves. We get to see them through their appearances, through their representations. That's as good as it's going to get, right? That's what we actually know. And so he says, listen, I'm not destroying the existence, the existence here, not Dasein, but existence of the thing that appears. So you don't really have to worry about that, right? And he says, is what I'm doing idealism? Can it be termed idealism? It is the very contrary. And then he says, long before Locke's time, he's talking about, you know, Locke's inquiries into how our understanding actually works. And Locke placed a great emphasis on the difference between primary and secondary qualities. Locke also was very dubious about our ever knowing the very substance of a thing either. But long before Locke's time, it was granted and assumed without detriment to the actual existence of external things that many of their predicates may be said to belong not to the things themselves, but to their appearances. So So heat, color, and taste, what we typically call secondary qualities. If I go further and rank the as mere appearances, the other remaining qualities of bodies, which are called primary, such as extension, place, and in general space, with all that belongs to it, like materiality or impenetrability, shape, nobody can adduce the reason of its being inadmissible. So, you know, really Kant is carrying out a move quite similar to what it is that Berkeley himself did and Hume did in their own work, saying this distinction between primary and secondary qualities that we see people like Descartes and Locke making, it doesn't really hold. I mean, they're all representations or appearances for us, right? So, you know, should we call that idealism? Kant says, not yet. And he says, I should be glad to know what my assertions must be in order to avoid all idealism. He's not going to actually avoid all idealism. He says, I should say the representation of space is not only perfectly conformable to the relation which our sensibility has to objects, but that it is completely like the object. And he says, well, that doesn't even make any sense. That's not a way to get out of this. And so in remark three, he goes on and he says, we can dismiss an objection that by admitting the ideality of space and time, the whole sensible world would be turned into mere illusion, Schein in this case. And that's related to Erscheinung, appearance, right? So he says, philosophical insight into the nature of sensuous cognition was spoiled by making sensibility merely a confused mode of representation. What's this? Well, you know, the rationalists, you see this in Leibniz, you see this in Descartes, right? Also in Spinoza to some degree, right? And he says, sensuous perception represents things not at all as they are, but in the mode in which they affect our senses, right? So we're always getting just representations or appearances. And he makes a really important distinction here. Appearance is given to sensibility, but sensibility doesn't actually engage in the judgment, right? And admitting the ideality of space and time doesn't mean the sensible world becomes mere illusion. It's the understanding that's actually making judgments. So we need to look at the understanding. And Kant is going to go on and say, listen, I am saying that space and time are forms of intuition that we can't get away from. We bring to whatever is out there, the things in themselves. But I also say we shouldn't go beyond possible experience with these concepts from space and time. And you other people have been doing that. How have you been doing that? Well, he gives you some examples. If I proclaim them qualities inherent in things in themselves, I don't know the things in themselves, right? So I can't say that they are qualities in those things. Or other possibilities would be saying that they could be intuited in some other way, some grasp in some other mode. Well, that's not going to work either. The only way that's going to work, according to Kant, is what he is presenting in the Critique of Pure Reason and here in the Prolegomena. So he doesn't want to go beyond possible experience with these concepts of space and time. It doesn't mean the actual experience, any possibility that we could actually have. And so this is going to allow him to distinguish different kinds of idealism. Now, he said that I want to avoid any idealism altogether. That's not going to happen. He is engaging in something that he is perfectly willing to call a certain type of idealism, right? And he says that the Critique of Pure Reason is the proper antidote to the other types of idealism. And he says that this is the only one that can actually prevent falling into illusions. So he says, I have given myself, my doctrine, the name of transcendental idealism. So do not confound it with the empirical idealism of Descartes or the mystical and visionary idealism of Berkeley. Our critique contains the proper antidote. As a matter of fact, you will find Kant talking explicitly about those two thinkers, as well as many others, in the critique. And so he says, my idealism concerns not the existence of things, because it never came into my head to doubt that existence, but it concerns the sensuous representation of things to which space and time especially belong. And he says, I've shown that space and time are neither things, but are mere modes of representation, nor are they determinations belonging to things in themselves. So this is an advance, according to Kant, past the errors, the erroneous types of idealism espoused by great thinkers like René Descartes and Bishop Berkeley. Now, He's going to also call Descartes' empirical idealism, dreaming idealism. There's a little dig at Descartes earlier on in this part, this discussion of idealism. How can we actually tell the difference between dreaming and reality? Well, it has to do with the coherence of what it is that we're experiencing, the representations, how they're connected together. I mean, Descartes says something kind of similar, but why is Descartes' idealism problematic here? Descartes is really telling us we can really only know in a certain way our own thinking, and the stuff that we're getting from the outside is merely probable. We can't be completely certain about it. Sensing is actually a mode of thinking, and it only happens in a thinking substance, not in those external objects. Berkeley is kind of going the other way and saying, you know, all we really have are these ideas about things. We can't really know what we are spirits. God is also a spirit, and spirits, by their very nature, are not ideas which we can grasp in that way. And Berkeley will go so far as to deny the existence of what most people call matter. So what is Descartes doing? He says that we don't want to convert actual things, not appearances, into mere representations. And then what is Berkeley doing? Changing mere representations into things. So, you know, we have dreaming idealism on the one hand, and then we have visionary idealism, and he says, both of which are to be refuted by my transcendental, or better, critical idealism. And why is it called critical idealism? Because we are engaging in a critique, an examination of how things work and the conditions for the possibility for the knowledge that we either have, like mathematics, or could have, like a future metaphysics, right? So Kant is, in fact, telling us, yes, this is a kind of idealism. It's not the kinds of idealism that you are used to and that you are rightly critical of and rejecting. What I'm doing is not saying there is no external world. It's just saying the only way that we get to it is through, you know, sensibility and then the judgments that the understanding forms about it. And those are working on representations, Vorstellungen, or appearances, Erscheinungen, and, you know, the conditions for these, for example, space and time as forms of sensible intuition, but also the basis of mathematics, you know, understood in terms of arithmetic and geometry, which we know actually are sciences. So Kant is showing us here what kind of critical idealism he's espousing and telling us to avoid non-critical idealism. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.